That's the music from the score of Schindler's List. Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Today is the final figure skating event at the Olympics, expected to bring in 25 million viewers. Early in the games, Russian skater Julia Lipnitskaya wowed audiences with her performance in Sochi. The music we opened with was the music that she danced to, but her costume and music also elicited some criticism. The art of the skate is one thing. The art of the whole package, from music to costume to the all-important choreography, is another. Joining us now is a Washington Post blogger who's been providing analysis for the Post about his favorite sport, figure skating. He usually covers social welfare issues, but his first research paper in journalism school at Northwestern was on the media coverage of the Nancy Kerrigan and Tanya Harding scandal. This month marks the 20th anniversary of that icy showdown for the ages. Welcome to the show, Robert Samuels.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The chatter has died down about Julia Lipnitskaya's performance during the team competition last week in the red costume and to the music from the score to Schindler's List. But did it remind us of the importance of the music and costume? What did you make of the criticism?
Well, the criticism was interesting. We'll see that performance again in the women's final tonight.
Okay.
And the costuming and the music, it's really what sells the program. It's very important for the second mark in figure skating, which is called the component score. It's the score for artistry. And if one of those things are awry, it can really put a bad taste in the judge's mouth. But more importantly, if people aren't into the music and don't feel that it's in sync with the costuming that the skater has, it could set aside, it could make the audience feel a little uncomfortable. It could disturb the audience. And when that happens, the skater will lose their passion and lose their power, and they'll perform worse than they would normally.
But she did beautifully.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Lipnitskaya, which is the, I'm not completely sure of the pronunciation, but Lipnitskaya, she possesses sort of the character that she is supposed to embody. The girl in red on the waiting for the train in Schindler's List. And the reason the music worked for her is because she has this steely, powerful presence about her. And it accentuates her power and her speed and also her youth, the fact that she's channeling a young girl in the movie and that she is a young girl worked to her advantage. Likewise, Michelle Kwan, when she started dressing up as sort of a sexy seductress of the Arabian tale Salome in the early 90s, she received criticism, actually, because she was so young and she was playing someone who was supposed to be so mature.
Mm-hmm. You recently wrote, by the way, Julia Lipnitskaya, you're right, I was mispronouncing it. She was in the team figure skating event with that. She'll be performing it again, you said, for the individual. You recently wrote with disdain about the team figure skating.
Oh, yeah.
This is the first year, right? This is the first year for that?
Right.
First explain what the team figure skating was, because I didn't really get it, not to mention the fact that I don't get any of the scoring anymore anyways, but that just dates me. Why don't you like it?
We can go through the scoring later.
Okay.
But team figure skating was sort of modeled after the team gymnastics competition, in which all skaters work together for a particular country, and the country then wins the competition. This is a very popular event in gymnastics, obviously. Everyone remembers Kerry Strug's big vault that won the United States the gold medal in 1996 in Atlanta. What has made team figure skating so perplexing for skaters and people who watch only every 4 years is that there's no real rhyme or reason to it. Everyone sort of performs the same routine. It happens before the more prestigious individual competitions. And so what you saw during the Olympics were that skaters were not really putting their all out there. They were saving some.
Hmm.
And the other thing about it was that because of the nature of the team competition, which was 3 days and included about 60 figure skating performances, it shrunk the amount of preparation time for those individual events. And I think that helped to contribute to some of the terrible performances we saw in the men's event, actually, where lots of people were falling. And that, I think, is because they didn't have the traditional preparation that people have for the Olympics.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest right now, Robert Samuels, he's a writer for The Washington Post, and he's been blogging about the figure skating at the Sochi Olympics. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about figure skating at the Olympics this hour, 614-292-8513. So what about that preparation for the Olympics? What is there a rhythm to it that most of the skaters follow? How do they do it?
There is. The typical skater nowadays, if you're going to be good, if you're going to compete for a medal, they typically perform two or three times internationally during the season, which starts roughly in September and heads all the way to the Olympics. And then they have their national championship. And so by the time a skater gets to the Olympics, they would have performed maybe four or five times in international competition. I think one of the hard things for people to realize when they watch skating, because it's based on this illusion of effortlessness, is how demanding those performances are physically. We ran a column by my colleague Sally Jenkins earlier last week that talked about the skater's heart rate is akin to someone running an 800-meter race at the Olympics. And this is going on for 4 minutes. It's very taxing on the body, and you've begun to see very serious injuries with skaters with hip problems, back problems, which took out the Russian legendary skater Evgeny Plyshenko in the men's mm-hmm. competition. And because of that, everything's very tenuous. And let's not forget that this is something a person is doing incredibly dangerous moves, going about 15 to 20 miles per hour on essentially a blade that's somewhere about an eighth of an inch thick on ice. So a person has to be really prepared, both mentally and physically, and they train to peak at the Olympic Games.
That's what I was going to ask you, kind of like a marathoner.
Yeah, absolutely.
When they do their performances at the Olympics, have they done them elsewhere? I know, of course, they've rehearsed them, but have they done them publicly elsewhere? Are these performances familiar to you, someone who follows it regularly?
Yeah, absolutely. By this point, we've seen most of the performances three or four times. Most of the top skaters, they compete twice a year in what's called sort of a figure skating Grand Prix, equivalent to NASCAR, and some other sports have that as well. And then the top figure skaters, they're invited to a third competition called the Grand Prix Final, which includes the top six competitors during that Grand Prix season. And so by the time we get to the Olympics, judges, skaters, and those who watch them regularly are familiar with what to expect in the competition. Scott Hamilton, the commentator, used to often say that a lot of the rankings that you see, a lot of the judging is done in practice, how well the skater has presented themselves throughout the year. That sort of gives judges more comfort in giving them the high marks when the pressure is on and things might be a little tough.
Nothing will top the scandal of Tanya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan 20 years ago. Nothing will. You said you were 9 years old and you were well aware of it at the time.
Absolutely.
But I mentioned that you wrote a research paper about it as a journalism student at Northwestern.
Right.
Is that what got you hooked on the sport?
Well,
is there some irony there? Because it was a total turnoff to a lot of us.
Yeah. Well, you know, my love for skating actually preceded Tanya and Nancy. It started because I had a childhood crush on on Christy Yamaguchi. Childhood teenage crush on Michelle Kwan. I had a Christy Yamaguchi when I was 7 years old, which was the same time as the 1992 Olympics in Albertville. But the interesting thing, Anna, is before Christy ever took to the ice, I was already enamored by the sport, the physicality of it, the jumps, the theatrical nature of it, and the fact that even though people are good, you can never really tell who's going to win. things happen. People slip, they fall. And the intense pressure was what compelled me to continue watching it, much to the confusion of my parents. and it was enhanced by what happened after Tanya and Nancy, which was that period when we saw figure skating competitions on every week. And because I was so into the sport, I took it to learn about all of the jumps and all of the players. And I'd actually tape the competitions and I'd rewatch them to listen to how Dick Button or Scott Hamilton presented a jump or sort of described what made one different from another.
Uh-huh.
And I'd rewatch the replays so I could get to the point that if they weren't commentating, I could tell for myself, or I could explain to my parents what the difference was between a Lutz and a flip and an axel. And that's come in handy as I've grown up, because now I wake up at 4 in the morning to watch some of these earlier pre-Olympic competitions on Russian live stream. And I don't need the commentators. I can just sort of watch it by myself and know what's going on.
Robert Samuels, are you a little miscast? Life. It's great. I've really enjoyed your posts.
Yeah.
Figure skating is known for its mixture of arts and athleticism. Do you think the athletic side is growing more important? You talked about that a little bit, but is the sport getting more difficult? It seems to me it is, but oh. I did not study it the way you did.
Absolutely. So what happened when they changed the scoring system from the 6.0 system to this convoluted scoring system we see today?
Thank you.
It moved the sport to become more difficult. And in some senses, by, you know, if we're judging by what we've seen in some of these competitions, pretty impossible, because it measures things like footwork and spinning, the depth of the edge, which is, you can tell an edge by the lean of a body, so how a skater leans. It has ways to measure and quantify all that. And so skaters gain points for doing a lot more difficult things. During the 6.0 system, people didn't gain points. They started with a perfect score and they lost points.
Hmm.
So that made skaters skate a lot more conservatively. And it put a lot more emphasis on simply jumping. Now a skater can't win just by jumping alone. They have to jump. They have to do fancy footwork sequences that go from one end to another. They have to spin. The typical spinner, you know, in the 80s and 90s revolved around 3 to 5 times. The typical spinner now, if they're good, they're spinning for twice as long. So that makes things considerably harder. And let's not forget, in men's figure skating, the dreaded quadruple jump, right? Which was first done by Kurt Browning in the 1980s, but really popularized itself in the late 1990s. And with the quadruple jump, combined with all of these things, it's really tiring for the legs. And so it's been hard, you know, it's been harder to understand because of the scoring system. It's been harder to do because of the scoring system. And it's actually been harder for the skaters. You're seeing a lot more people with a lot more serious injuries because of it.
What have been your favorite moments from Sochi so far? And what tell us what to look for tonight.
Well, Sochi's been an interesting Olympics. It hasn't been as compelling as some of the previous ones, but we've had some great moments, right? We saw the first American team in ice dance win a gold medal in a performance that was spellbinding. It seemed so easy and it flew by so quickly. And it was hard for us to imagine that this was just as long as some of the other programs. It went by so quickly. And I think that's really a important moment for figure skating, because ice dance has sort of been the joke of the game. Now it's one of the more compelling competitions. I thought the programs that we saw yesterday were interesting. We saw a lot of women perform really well, and we saw some questionable scoring in my mind and in the minds of lots of others. The South Korean skater in Yuna Kim, in first place, her name's Yuna Kim. She should have been a lot farther ahead, and now she's locked in this three-person battle for the gold medal. And then you have an American, Gracie Gold, following her, and Lipnitskaya, whose music you just played.
Mm-hmm.
So tonight, what we're going to see is really a measure of the scoring system. We're going to see if these women who are going to, or we're going to see whether or not they're going to succumb to the pressure of the Olympics. Yuna Kim, who's in front, is usually in front by 10 or 12 points. Hmm. Now she's in front by less of a point. We don't know how that's going to affect her. Carolina Costner, who's an Italian skater who's been around for about a decade, she has a newfound elegance and maturity. And quite frankly, she's a pretty sexy skater, which judges like. And so if she skates well, she's my pick for the gold medal. And don't count out the United States' Gracie Gold, who was a little off yesterday, but was rewarded handsomely. And this program, the long program, is her specialty because it's 2 minutes longer than the first event in this competition. And she's a tremendous jumper, and she's able to pack a lot more technical content within that 4 minutes. And so she might do really well. And of course, the world will be watching to see how little Lipnitskaya, the 15-year-old Russian phenom, will do as well, because she truly was spellbinding and wonderful in the team competition, and she has been all year. And so I think lots of people are rooting for her to do as well as we know she can do.
Robert Samuels, it's been delightful talking with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
No problem.
Robert Samuels, he's a writer for The Washington Post, and he writes a figure skating blog for The Post as well. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The music of Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade, the music for U.S. figure skaters Merrill Davis and Charlie White's gold medal performance on Tuesday. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. More than 25 million viewers around the world are expected to tune in tonight for the final skating event for the 2014 Games in Sochi. Fans the world over are drawn to the elaborate costumes, romantic music, and sometimes fantastical acrobatics. When the best in the world put it all together, it can seem like magic. Joining us now, and perhaps to demystify some of that, is About.com's figure skating expert. She is a former competitive skater and skating coach, the mother of three competitive figure skaters herself, and the author of a soon-to-be-published memoir, My Skating Life, Joanne Schneider-Ferris. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Scheherazade by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov has been a very popular choice of music for skaters. Is it just safe, or is there something more to it? What goes into that choice of music?
Well, the figure skating music is usually decided about a year, sometimes 2 years before a skating competition. It's not always classical music. Sometimes movies, musicals are used. In the ice dancing right now, music with vocals can be used. That's going to soon change, where the other disciplines are going to be able to use vocal music. But what happens is usually hours and hours of listening goes on before, and it's not always from the skater, and it's not always even from their coach. Sometimes it's done where the coach hires a separate choreographer and asks the choreographer to decide what would be the best music for a particular skating student. And yes, like you said, music, that classical music from the masters, is always safe. You can't really go wrong. And so sometimes that is a first choice.
What about the issue early on last week with the music from Schindler's List and the Russian skater Julia Lipnitskaya?
Well, that could have been considered appropriate for her just because of her heritage, or it could have been just considered that that would be a nice piece of music that would fit with her skating. There wouldn't have been a lot of controversy or decision based on it. It might have been that she skates well to that particular kind of music. And again, a choreographer might have spent a lot of time discussing with the coach and deciding what costume would go well with her skating mm-hmm. before that music was chosen.
But they do they talk about possible controversies, anything like that? I think my last guest mentioned maybe Christina Yamaguchi skating to a character that was probably a little too mature for her at one point.
Yeah, they would probably talk about what kind of controversy would exist if a skater uses a certain piece. But a lot of times it doesn't make any difference. For example, sometimes you will see a skater that is Jewish skating to Jesus Christ Superstar. It doesn't have anything to do with their faith or their beliefs. It's just that it's appropriate music that will work with their skating.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Joanne Schneider-Ferris, a figure skating expert, and the About.com figure skating expert as well. How is a routine choreographed? You said they hire a choreographer to do it. How much do the skaters themselves ever get involved in that process?
Well, it does vary. Generally, it can be done two ways. So it very rarely is it done by the skater alone. That does happen once in a while. But generally, what happens if a coach feels that their niche is not choreography, they will hire a separate choreographer to choreograph a student's programs. Especially at this Olympic level. Very rarely at this Olympic level is the coach the only choreographer. There are people that are able to do some of their own choreography. For an example, Johnny Weir, he had a very big statement in what he did in his programs. Kara Lipinski, who you're seeing, who won the 1998 Olympic title, probably did not choreograph her programs at all. She was so young at the time that I'm sure that everything was done by her coach and choreographer.
I heard an interview with Meryl Davis, who with Charlie White won the gold medal this Tuesday in couples. She said that she and Charlie really studied the history of that music and the culture of the music. She was coached by a Persian dance coach to prepare.
Oh, okay. Well, what happened with ice dance, it's a little bit different. That is very, very common for the ice dancers to really understand what they're skating to and doing exactly what Meryl explained. Because if they don't, they can't interpret the music, especially in front of millions of people at the Olympics. Their coach, though, is considered one of the best ice dance coaches, probably right now the best ice dance coach in the world. And so she would even know more than the skaters before giving them that piece of music to skate to.
We hear that one coach will coach different teams that are competing against each other. Have you ever done that? And what is that like in the business?
It's very, very tough. It's almost puzzling to think that happened with the Canadian ice dancers, Virtue and Moyer, and Americans, Davis and White, because the parents of the skaters and the skaters and themselves put in so much money that when they hire a coach, they really want the coach to give them their all. On a personal note, my own children who compete in ice, well, now they're competing in pair skating, but they were competing in ice dancing at first, had been with a certain coach since they were very, very young and had placed at the national championships at the juvenile level. About a year or two later, that coach took on two skaters that I knew were going to be tough competition for my children. Mm-hmm. And it was a very difficult experience for me as a parent to wonder how we could really be true teammates when I knew that the other ice dance team had a very good chance of beating them for a medal at the national level. And that's actually what happened. From the children's point of view, I think that they tried very hard to be good sports. I think for me as a parent, the same thing. I do know that virtual Tessa Virtue and Scott Moyer did voice, it's been voiced, they voiced publicly that there was some kind of friction because the two teams took from the same coach. And it is, I think it is puzzling for those of us in the skating world to wonder how that worked.
What is the difference between pair skating and ice dancing?
It's quite a bit of difference. It doesn't look a lot of lot different to the average viewer. But first of all, the ice dancers that compete are required before they even get to where they are to do what is called pattern ice dancing. It used to be called compulsory ice dancing. And if you go back and look at videos from the 1976 Winter Olympic Games when ice dancing first appeared, or even in 84 when Jane Torval and Christopher Dean won gold. What got them that gold medal was not the free dance, which is what we see on television with the lifts and the spins and the step sequences and the twizzles, but what was their compulsory ice dances. When they did set patterns, all the dancers did the same patterns, waltzes and tangos and foxtrots. Even at the last Olympics, the compulsory dance was a part of the ice dance event. So the viewers could see that before they saw the lifts and the spins. So that's where one of the differences is that the dancers that you see at the Olympics originally all learned how to do those compulsory ice dances, including Tessa Virtue and Scott Moyer and Meryl Davis and Charlie White. There are some videos online of Meryl and Charlie doing the Willow Waltz, which is a very low-level beginning pattern dance. The pair skaters do not do any pattern dances or anything on the ice even before they get there. They are doing lifts that are above the head that are fully extended, which aren't allowed in ice dancing. They are doing spins together that are similar to the ones that are done in ice dancing, which are called pair or ice dance spins. But they also do side-by-side spins that are done either in a mirror form or done exactly in unison. They do not do twizzles. The twizzles are those turns that you see the ice dancers doing that go straight down the ice. They resemble spins. And pair skaters, they might do twizzles in their step sequence, but they are not required to do twizzles. Both types of skating involve step sequences, but the step sequences in ice dancing are really the heart of ice dancing. Sometimes that's what can break or make a team in their scores. If their step sequence gets a level 4 rating and plus 3 scores, you know, that could cause their scores to go way up. In pair skating, of course, the step sequence makes a difference, but it's not all of the difference. The other thing in pair skating is there's throws and twists. So you'll see the boy throw the girl in the air, and she will do a triple loop or a throw triple sow cow.
Scary. Are twizzles, everyone's saying, oh, we're just hearing about twizzles this year. Are twizzles dangerous?
Well, I don't know if they're really dangerous. They are.
It all looks dangerous to me, I suppose. Yeah. Okay. They are hard to do. Are skaters, well, can you tell us when figure skating began, how far back it goes, and when it became an Olympic sport?
Okay, well, figure skating actually started probably somewhere in the middle of the, maybe even the 16th or 17th century.
Really?
People were playing around on ice skates, but really sometime in the mid-1800s, it became popular for the wealthy classes, especially, to go skate on ponds, and it was mostly men, to go on ponds and kind of spend their time making patterns on the ice, not doing all these steps and jumps and spins that we see. Then, near the end of the 1890s, around even before the turn of the century, a man named Jackson Haynes, he started fiddling around with doing movements on the ice, and it was actually called the American style of skating. And it didn't actually go over where people did, you know, they took ballet and they put it on the ice. And it didn't go over in America at all. But his style of skating became kind of the new craze. It was still mostly done by men. There were women that did it. But the real heart of figure skating, and one reason it's called figure skating, is because of the designs that were done on the ice, which were called figures, which were called compulsory figures. Hmm. These tracings that were done on the ice were judged and had to be done perfectly. So the first Olympics, which was actually the Summer Olympics in 1908, which took place in London, premiered figure skating as an event. And the skaters that participate, they could actually just pretty much, you know, arrive there. They were from very wealthy classes and sign up and compete.
I am talking with Joanne Schneider Ferris, figure skating expert. She is with About.com, their figure skating expert. She's also the author of a soon-to-be-published memoir. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about about figure skating at the Olympics, the 2014 Olympics in Sochi. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Once again, the music of Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade. That's the music for U.S. ice dancers Merrill Davis and Charlie White's gold medal performance on Tuesday. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We've talked about Olympic solo, pairs, ice dancing, team figure skating. But what if the whole team performed together on the ice at the same time? It's called synchronized skating and is growing in popularity throughout the U.S. and abroad. And it may have a role in the next Olympic Games. Still with us is figure skating expert Joanne Schneider Ferris. Joanne, once again, thanks for joining us.
Yes. Nice to be here.
And joining us now is OSU's synchronized skating coach. She trained alongside Michelle Kwan and has shared the spotlight with skating greats such as Scott Hamilton, Christy Yamaguchi, and Brian Botano. Welcome to the show, Megan McKinley.
Thank you, Anne. Thanks for having me.
Tell us more about how synchronized skating works, Megan.
Well, synchronized skating, for someone who's never seen the sport before, I like to describe it as a combination of marching band, so a lot of people making shapes, rockets, they've got the precision and the grace, and then a little bit of ice dance. So we've got those three elements of various sports coming into one to create the synchronized skating.
Is there a tie to synchronized swimming?
Very much so. It looks the same, although now the water is frozen and we're on top and we're skating, but the synchronicity of the sport is very similar.
And are they all still smiling all the time?
Depending on the character that they're portraying.
What's the process for developing a synchronized routine?
Number one, find the music. Find something that is going to be appropriate for your team. I think the other speakers have spoken about how important music selection is to a performance. So understanding your athletes, understanding what their power is, and then creating a program around that.
Joanne Schneider Ferris, I said that it's growing in popularity across the country. What do you make of it? Looking back over history, do you think it has a role here?
Oh, I love synchronized skating. I was fortunate to have attended three synchronized figure skating national championships and also get to go to Synchro Worlds in Colorado Springs. It is the most fun, exciting, and most wonderful part of skating. My real wish is that it does become an Olympic sport. It would open up so many doors for so many skaters, and it is definitely something that should be added to the Olympic venue.
Megan McKinley, what drives an individual into synchronized skating versus any of the other opportunities out there?
Well, figure skating can be a lonely sport. It's a very individual sport. You're training alongside with your coach. And synchronized skating allows these athletes to take the skills that they've learned in individualized skating and bring it into a team setting. So now you get to learn all of those great dynamics of what it's like to be on a team, what it's like to have leadership, what it's like to be cooperative in a goal. And so they get to learn different aspects of team building as well as sport of figure skating.
How did you get into it?
I was lucky enough that my first figure skating coach that I stepped on the ice with basic, the first time I ever stepped on the ice, I kept that coach, and she happened to be the synchronized skating coach at our rink. So she kind of helped lead me into that path. And it was a great, why would I not want to hang out with more of my friends, more time on the ice? It was great fun.
When did synchronized skating emerge? How many years has it been now?
1959. So, okay. You know, the early 60s is when it first started in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And it's grown from there. It started out as precision skating and since has changed names for the International Skating Union. Most European countries don't have a name that equates to precision.
Okay.
So it's evolved already in its existence with its name being more specific to European and world competitions.
How many people are on the ice at the same time, and is it women and men at the same time, or just women, or just men? Or
depending on the division, there can be a mixture of both men and women, and depending on the level, between 8 to 20 skaters on the ice at one time.
What we're used to seeing triple axels and jumps in traditional figure skating, I act like I know what I'm talking about, but what moves, and they call it synchro, right?
Correct.
What moves is synchro known for?
Synchro is known for intersections, something that you do not see with any of the other domains.
And that's that marching band
that
thing
is
just
where.
Okay.
So if you have 20 skaters going 20 miles an hour with weapons on their feet, trying to slide through a tiny little hole that another skater has made for them to make that clean. I would say that's a crowd pleaser. Whenever we perform at Blue Jackets games here in the community, they may not know the twizzles, but they know the intersections.
You know, Joanne Schneider-Ferris, it's kind of funny, but I'm starting to think you guys are a little crazy. And it's dangerous.
Yes, there are, once in a while, there are collisions on the ice, whether it's single skating, pair skating, ice dancing, or synchronized skating.
When Megan referred to them as weapons on your feet.
Well, you know, there sometimes are horrific accidents, and but skaters take that in stride, and usually, unless they're hurt, they get up and they keep going. If there's a really bad accident, we're all very, very sad to hear about it.
Let's go back to the issue of Olympics. Joanne Schneider-Ferris, what is the process for getting a new event in the Olympics?
Well, that takes really a long time. For example, roller skating, if you notice, we don't have anything similar to ice skating. Roller skating actually has artistic skaters that do exactly the same thing that we do on the ice.
You've written about it, right?
Has never made it into the Olympics. There's been moves to try to for years to try to make that happen, and I think that's probably what synchronized skating has run into. What I've heard, and Megan might be able to correct me on this, I've heard that there's been concern that the Olympic Village wouldn't have enough room for all the skaters in synchronized skating teams, and that's one of the things that stopped synchronized figure skating from getting into the Olympics.
Just the sheer cost of room and board.
You know, Joanne, that's a great comment regarding the amount of skaters that would actually fit in the Olympic Village. Due to the restraints of the space that they have, we've actually condensed the amount of skaters that we have on a team to hopefully help in our bid to become this Olympic sport. So there used to be 20 to 24 people on the ice. Now we've lessened it to 16 to 20.
Because it wouldn't be any fun if there wasn't enough of them.
Right.
It doesn't look right. When you see a really small synchro team, sometimes a town a small city or a small college has a hard time getting a group of skaters together. It just doesn't look the same as when there's a big team out on the ice, too.
It looks like a couple of pairs or skate dancers got lost.
Right.
Is synchro as physically demanding as solo or pair skating or skate dancing?
Absolutely. I believe that it is just as physical. You have to be able to do the endurance. You have to be able to do the 4-minute program. And the mental toughness that comes along with the sport is also a major factor. Something in synchronized skating that I think is unique is the teammate aspect, the team cohesion. When you have 16 skaters that are on the ice, those 16 skaters should be on the ice. Now, what happens if someone gets hurt? You have an alternate skater that comes in, but the mentality of someone maybe that you don't know, have not skated next to, and then you have that intersection coming up, just the mental acuity that you need to have and spatial awareness for that many people around you and for you to be in the exact same spot that you need to be in. I think that that's very unique.
One thing I want to talk about that we haven't gotten to yet, Joanne and Megan, is costuming. But before we do, just let's stick with the synchro right now. And how do the costumes differ for them compared to the other events, the other types of skating?
Generally, the skirts tend to be a little bit longer just in dance to make it look a bit more flowy. But costuming in certain levels, you can add adornments. So if you wanted to add the crystals, you could. In the higher levels, you can do that with international competition. But the lower levels, when they're trying to keep costs and participation very much at even level, they don't allow any of those adornments.
So Joanne Schneider-Ferris, let's talk about costuming and where that comes from and how that's developed. We talked about the music and choreography, but how big of a deal is the costume? Sometimes I see a skater and I think, that looks like something you could have seen back in the 1960s. And then there are such great innovations every 4 years.
Well, it depends really on the coach when it comes to a costume.
Really?
Some coaches will have a say. Other coaches will say, well, let the choreographer figure out the costume. And if the choreographer gets involved, they will usually deal, or the coach, they will usually meet with a seamstress or who is going to design and ask for some designs. In my experience, fortunately, when my children were competing in ice dance, the ice dance coach that I chose also designed costumes. And she was very, very picky on what she wanted. And she sent drawings to a seamstress and we discussed the costumes. After the seamstress came up with drawings based on what the design was, then she would fit the children and come up with an initial costume that a lot of times was sent back. There was a clip with Johnny Weir showing Johnny having that same influence rather than his coach having the influence. He had an idea what he wanted. He told his seamstress what he wanted. She put things together. He didn't like it, and she kept redoing it. It's very common at the Olympic level for the person that actually makes these costumes for the skaters to do these things over and over. Same thing goes for pair skating. A lot of times with pair skating, it's safety is an issue too. What the girl wears has to be safe, so when the boy throws her in the air and catches her, that he doesn't run into a stone or a rhinestone. And once in a while, the skaters make up their own costumes, do drawings, give it to the seamstress, the coach approves it, and that's what they wear.
Megan just grimaced a little at that. There's an art to costuming, and skaters don't necessarily know.
Absolutely. I think that's why you hire a coaching staff, is to help make you help in those decisions. They're there to help foster you as a student. And when maybe they see you having some interest, a great coach would say, hey, here's a couple of ideas that I have. Do you like number one or number two? Give them a little bit of independence to pick, but within a realm that you feel is appropriate for your skater, that's what you're there for.
What did you like to skate in?
I love to skate in anything purple. I'm a purple girl, but okay. Anything purple, anything sparkly, something that was lightweight and obviously was flowing on the ice.
I, you know, love all of that, but I really love the Italian, they're the skate dancers.
Yes.
competition, and they did sort of something from 42nd Street. Mm-hmm. I loved her longer skirt and the way it moved through the air.
There's definitely an aesthetic to skating. I tell my students all the time that we are in a sport where it matters what it looks like when we're doing something. So it comes
down. Which is different.
Absolutely. So it doesn't matter if you land that triple axel or you make that splice. If it doesn't look good when you're doing it, you're not going to get the grade of execution points that you need to be rewarded for that.
And I just wanted to mention something about the ice dance costumes. They have really evolved. When I competed at the National Championships in ice dancing, I wore a traditional skating dress with some stones on it. And that was what was worn in the 70s and even in the 80s. The long, beautiful dresses that the girls wear in ice dancing is really a recent thing.
It's a beautiful thing, I think. Do you like it?
Oh, it's so much better. I think that that's what probably I would want to wear those outfits. They're so much prettier than a short skating skirt. It's nice to look like a ballroom dancer on the ice.
And then have the leeway to reflect or represent the music and the culture that you're dancing to.
Right. And the other thing that happened in ice dancing was the first time I saw ice dancing, I thought, who would want to do this? Everybody was wearing black.
Huh.
And now look at all the colors. You just want to be out there wearing those colors.
I imagine, Megan, too, it's technology. The fabrics and so forth are evolving all the time.
The construction has changed even since when I was competitive.
How do they hold them together?
Well, there's unique ways. There's there's a couple of different ways that you could
tricks.
Do it. Tricks of the trade. Most commonly is just a zipper, either in the side or in the back. In the early 90s, they were getting rid of the zippers and putting then snaps to adhere them to our bodies. So they're always innovative with how they're going
to. You mean putting snaps on your body?
No.
Okay.
Snaps.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So, Joanne, you've been around. Comfort level better now?
Well, I had a hard time, believe it or not, I go so far back. I'm in the days where we had polyester double knit, and even before that, the outfits had two pieces that were made out of cotton, and we had darts, and the invisible zipper was a new thing. When things started getting so close and form-fitting, it was hard for us because then everything showed, but of course, everything has improved so much, and it's getting better and better.
And they have the fabric that, what do you call it?
Illusion.
Illusion, right. That's pretty typical. Is it required?
It's not.
It's a comfort thing.
It's a comfort. If you're not going to have straps on your dress, you probably want to have something there that's going to help hold it up or hold anything in.
Tell us about the OSU Synchronized Skating Team. Who are they? Where they come from? And where are they competing next?
They come from all over the United States. A lot of them are Ohio natives. They are a group of girls that are dedicated to empowering women in the sport of synchronized skating. Though we are a smaller team in comparison to some of the other teams that are out there, we are very fierce in our determination to make this a successful program.
When you compete in skating for a university, do you usually wear the university colors necessarily?
You would usually wear them, and depending on whether or not you are recognized as a varsity sport at your school, there could be some funding or some other things that you could get for uniforming.
Are you recognized as a varsity sport?
We are not. There are only two schools in the entire United States that are. So we are currently a club sport, and we're looking to be the 38th varsity sport at the Ohio State University.
All right. Well, good luck on that. And Megan McKinley, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann.
And Joanne Schneider-Ferris, thanks to you as well for joining us. Really appreciate your time and your comments.
Thank you very much.
Joanne Schneider-Ferris, she's a figure skating expert for About.com, and she has a soon-to-be-published memoir. You can look for that. And Megan McKinley, she's the head coach for the OSU Synchronized Skating Team. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.